I will talk about China's achievements versus Western mythology. I found this to be important in the discussion of hybrid war because the information war is a huge part of ensuring that the many pillars of this hybrid war are able to continue onward unabated and unchallenged. So one of the biggest ways that we can challenge this information war, the misinformation we hear about China, is by going to China. And it is truly humbling to discuss this occasion of the 75th anniversary of the People's Republic of China when the world is facing a multitude of crises due to hybrid war, due to a global hybrid war led by the United States. Many people have brought up Palestine, have brought up what's happening to Lebanon right now, have brought up the slain leader, resistance leader Hassan Nasrallah. There's also, of course, the meat grinder in Ukraine, this US-NATO failed campaign to strategically defeat Russia. This has all brought the world, including the hybrid war on China, to the brink of a potential nuclear conflict, and I think it's important to recognize that. In hybrid war, the victories that people have fought so hard to win is the thread that binds these crises together. So in late August, I traveled to China for the fourth time in as many years and witnessed once again what the Chinese people have accomplished in their 75 years of building socialism and building an independent Chinese nation, or what China is increasingly called a rejuvenated Chinese nation. Truthfully, in my opinion, it is really shocking, actually, that now traveling to China, one of the most open and globally integrated economically nations in the world, is becoming and has become so controversial over the past decade especially. But when you go to China, the achievements are nothing short of astounding, and you just can't run from them. You can lie about them, but you can't run from them. So the streets are clean, the infrastructure is modern, it's very modern. So this was actually the first time I had ridden two high-speed rail trains before this, but this was the first time I rode the Fuxing, and this is the high-speed rail that connects Shanghai to Beijing. And for context, that distance is about 1,200 kilometers. This train can go 350 kilometers an hour, and you can get to one end of Beijing to Shanghai in about 4 hours. And just for some context, in the United States, if you want to travel this distance, say New York to Chicago, your fastest train here will be 19 hours. So the feat, this feat alone is, I think, incredibly just shocking for many Americans and even Westerners, where there might be high-speed rail in Spain or somewhere else, but the trains are slower. China has now become the world leader in this very key infrastructure development. When I was in China's two most developed cities, Shanghai and Beijing, I was able to interview renowned intellectuals like Zhang Weiwei, who actually participated in this event, and former People's Liberation Army Colonel Zhou Bo. And from their insights, it is clear that China has indeed stood up and is now producing intellectuals and is now producing knowledge that reflects its status as not just a rising global power, but just a global power. China is now asking, what is its responsibility to the world, and what does it mean to lead? And prior to New China, so prior to the 75th anniversary, the 75th year of its founding, the impoverished and humiliating position that foreign powers subjected on China raised different kinds of questions, questions of subsistence and just basic dignity. So you can imagine that the enormity of this shift over the past 75 years just cannot be understated. What's striking when you spend time in China is this huge gap between Western media mythology and reality, which is, again, a critical component of this hybrid war. Just take the economy, for example. In the Western media, we hear story after story of China's coming economic collapse. In China, issues and real problems, economic challenges such as lower consumer spending, are viewed differently, not as a sign of collapse, but as the modest pains of a transition period. China is currently undergoing a unique transition, one that right now not many countries can say they are going through, which is from a low value added manufacturing powerhouse to a high value added tech giant on its way to modern socialism. So lower real estate prices are not viewed as some kind of crisis that the whole system is going to fall. That's just projection. That's what happens in the United States when the housing market here, controlled by Wall Street, goes into a crisis where prices fall and people are thrown out of their homes. That is viewed as an economic crisis. In China, there's a saying, there's a new slogan that was inaugurated under Xi Jinping, which is that housing is for living and not speculation. So many people, there aren't people being thrown out of their homes all over the place in China like happens here, but a lot of people will tell you that lower housing prices are actually welcomed, especially in the big cities where the cost of living got quite high over the past several decades. Reduced economic growth, 4 to 6% per year in GDP terms, is not a reason to panic in China, but the outgrowth of a particular plan. And for some context, 4 to 6% growth is still 2 to 3 times higher than Europe and the United States. But this is seen in the Western media as a huge crisis because at one point in the 90s and the early 21st century, China was growing at 10% plus. But the plan that China is undergoing right now is to inject momentum and capital into industries that will make China both the center of innovation on the planet and an economy that can open new heights for the standard of living of Chinese people. And this plan is working. Beyond slightly decreasing rates of GDP growth are explosions of growth in important fields such as renewable energy and high technology development. Huawei just released the first ever tri-fold phone with iPad-like capabilities, something that is very hard, I think, to imagine for people in the collective West who have never seen such a thing. China's undisputed leadership in the development of new energy vehicles. For example, China not only holds the majority of the world's electric vehicles in general, but about 98% of the electric buses in the entire planet. The fact that renewable energy drives about 40% of all economic growth in China, and the 13 to 14% year-on-year growth of high technology makes China's path toward a modern socialist country increasingly and abundantly clear in contrast to the collapse narratives of the United States and Western mainstream media. China right now is dealing with a historic contradiction not faced by any other country on Earth right now. The existence of relative poverty and uneven development in the face of growing abundance and a major drive toward common prosperity. That is, everyone is getting richer, incomes are growing, but it's not even just yet, and it can't be even just yet. Huge sacrifices were made and are still made in order to ensure China has this productive capacity, what Marxists like to call productive forces, necessary to achieve the goals of socialism with Chinese characteristics at an early stage. And now the emphasis is on quality development. So this is where the rubber meets the road on economic growth. It's not a reason to panic when an economy is growing 4 to 6% and quality is emphasized. So when you go to China, like I have just recently, you see this everywhere. Electric vehicles dominate eerily quiet city roads. The smoggy skies of the biggest cities are now blue. Public transit is pristine and cheap at around 50 US cents per ride. China is the land of an overwhelming number of domestically produced apps that can get you anything delivered from a meal to groceries to a mirror in under 30 minutes at an incredibly low price. At the end of my trip, I actually became sick with some mild congestion. And on numerous occasions, I had people help me buy traditional Chinese medicine online for just a few US cents to a dollar. And I would get it in a half hour or less delivered to me. So technology and tourism, you can imagine, are booming. And you can see this when you go to the Bund, which I did in Shanghai on a Monday evening, and it was absolutely packed, thousands of people. Some people tell me that it gets up to 1 million people on the Bund on some of the busiest days, and hundreds of thousands easily every single day. Or the lines out the door when new releases of Chinese-made products, such as the Huawei Mate XT, that tri-fold phone I was talking about, hits the shelves. I got to spend a week in Xinjiang this time around. I've been there once before, but this was my second visit, and it was my most memorable because I visited, and this is a big part of the hybrid war and information war on China. I visited an exhibition on the terrorism that happened there in Xinjiang. It witnessed huge displays meant to educate new officials, new police officers, and other people of the horrors that transpired over the course of the period of 1990 and 2016, when thousands of attacks brought instability and killed or injured thousands. I spoke with academics, business owners, ordinary people, and a threat emerged. Xinjiang is not the nightmare we are told in the Western media. It's more peaceful than it has ever been. It is more prosperous than it has ever been. It is more ethnically unified than it has ever been. This last statement garners the most controversy in the collective West. I spoke with an imam at a mosque. I saw dancing and celebrations in the streets every single day, wherever you went. And I crossed the Belt and Road into Kazakhstan and back in a matter of minutes. There's an open border. There's booming trade between Kazakhstan and the five Central Asian countries, Russia included, and China. The wealth of ethnic diversity in Xinjiang, when you go to places like the Kazakh Autonomous Prefecture and all along its borders, is bringing with it an immense advantage under China's socialist economy, as tradition and culture is not only preserved but elevated to benefit both the increases of income of local people and to integrate the economy of the entire country and Xinjiang in particular with their neighbors to the west onward toward the rest of Europe. This is a huge hallmark of the poverty alleviation campaign, but truthfully, the Belt and Road Initiative that directly questions the illegitimacy of what we see in the information war on China, the but at what cost narrative. How much is this costing? What is the cost of integrating China with the rest of the world? What is the cost of alleviating poverty? What is the cost we hear over and over again of China's particular policies with regard to Xinjiang? Well, actually, the cost is really a benefit. A critical element of the hybrid war on China is ideological. Information war goes hand in hand with the US Empire's stated policy on containment. Containment is really just a nice word that sums up the US elite's anxiety about China as not only the biggest perceived threat to US hegemony, but one that is incapable of defeating China in a conventional war. We are being told by every segment of the ruling elite to hate China, to misunderstand China, and to fear China. The more we hate, the more we misunderstand, and the more we fear China, the easier it is for the rest of the hybrid war's economic and military policies to continue unchallenged. But I have the utmost confidence from both my travels and study that China will continue to reach new heights on the path to modern socialism. The Chinese people will defend their sovereignty with every inch of their lives. China's role as leader of the multipolar world will grow by leaps and bounds. It is we, the people here residing in the United States, those of us in this room, those of us watching, those of us who are unable to be in this room, who are not watching, who have the most work to do to win the kind of society that is driven by people's interests rather than naked profit, and peace rather than endless war. This is the biggest contribution we could make to the global class struggle, and indeed, this is China's biggest lesson to us all, because that is what they have won for themselves, and the benefits of their victory are being felt far and wide, inside and outside of China. Thank you so much. Thank you all for coming.